Hi, Dan.
Hi, Jason.
Well, we were together in Cupertino, Sunnyvale, various places in the Bay Area, but we're now back in our respective homes.
That's correct. Did not record a podcast.
We did not do a secret Six Colors magical bonus podcast from WWDC. Too busy. Too busy. Too much to do.
A lot going on.
Too many things going on. But that's okay. I'm exhausted. My son's graduation from high school was yesterday. We are now... I mean, we're not really empty nesters because, you know, actually both children are in the nest right now, but it's trending that way. So
it's imminent.
Kind of exhausting week. You have any high level sort of thoughts about what we learned this week in Cupertino?
Yeah, it's interesting. My Macworld piece that ran before the keynote was talking about sort of themes for a lot of the releases in terms of like, yeah, sort of big picture ideas for how Apple might sort of pitch some of these things. Some of those, I think, came out pretty well, actually. My theme for iOS 16 was customization, which was a big part of the iOS 16 conversation. And my theme for iPadOS 16 was power, which I also think was a big part of that conversation. And looking at it from a sort of zoomed out point of view, I wrote my Macworld column this forthcoming week about... So, Jason, you and I have been around this community for a long time. There is a subset of people who have this impression that the best release of software that Apple ever put out was... Can you guess what I'm going to say?
Mountain Lion? Snow Leopard?
Snow Leopard, yes.
Snow Leopard,
why?
Because they had no features. We didn't do anything except fix things.
Yes, exactly. And people will make this occasional, like, they should do a release like that where they just fix all the bugs, despite the fact that...
It just works.
They would be in so much trouble if they released something with features. I mean, those same people would probably be really upset, but also, you know... The financial people wouldn't like it, and there'd be a lot of castigation in the tech press, blah, blah, blah. Anyways, what I think they did, which was very clever with this release, and you and Mike alluded to this too on Upgrade, is there's a lot of gap filling in this. There's a lot of things that have been sort of floating around for a long time that Apple's like, you know what? We're just going to check that off. And they didn't get everything, obviously. I mean, they got to pick and choose. But... So much of what got released this year felt like things that had been like, hey, people have been talking about this not being there for a long time. We're going to go ahead and do that. To the point of the whole idea, this was sort of best encapsulated in that whole iPadOS idea of desktop class apps, which you wrote about a bit this week on Six Colors, which is this idea of the iPad grew out of the iPhone and iOS, right? And it's always occupied this weird place where it's kind of between the iPhone and the Mac in terms of its where it came from and where it's sort of aspiring to. And I felt like this was shifting more stuff towards the idea of it becoming more Mac-like. And that involves plugging a lot of gaps in functionality, things that you couldn't do on the iPad where Apple's like, you know what, we should just make this easier to do, or we should find a way to accommodate this, especially... with the release of the you know, pointing device interface with it in the last couple of years. So I think a lot of this felt like kind of some sort of tidying up, some straightening up, some like realigning things as they sort of try to bring all these platforms into parity, which is, of course, something they've shot for the last few years because it makes life easier for everybody. It makes life easier for us as users because you can move to a different device and kind of have expectations about what will work and you know what you'll be able to do. And it makes things easier for them because when they roll out new updates, new features that come to existing software, they can roll them out across the board.
Right.
And you don't end up in a situation where it's like, well, I can do this on my Mac, but I can't do it on my iPad, or vice versa. I can do this on iOS. Why can't I do it on macOS? Especially now that everything is not only running kind of the same underlying code in a lot of cases, but also the same underlying hardware. So I think that is sort of my big takeaway from this, is it felt much more like there was a fascinating conversation at the talk show, which has just gone up, I think, as we record this on Friday, where they talked about, I totally lost my train of thought.
Oh, no.
It was going to be good, though. It was going to be great. Let me see if I can find it out. It was about how they organized the keynote. they have debates about organizing via platform, which apparently is something that Jaws really pushes for in the keynotes. Is like, we're going to do this here. We're going to talk about iOS. Right. We're going to talk about Mac. We're going to blah, blah,
but
blah.
It's hard because so much of the stuff so is much across stuff all the platforms. You can't
yeah.
really do it.
So I feel like we might be trending towards a day where yeah. Apple decides instead to talk about updates to things that are across all the platforms and then maybe save some little... You know, there are things that yeah. are suited maybe to one platform or another, and those could be sort of the minority instead of the majority is to everything. So I think mm-hmm. we're in the middle of that shift right now. That's kind of my read on it.
I think that's a good read. There's a lot going on. I thought it was funny that the banner feature of the iPad, which is support for external displays and a windowing system, was introduced as a Mac feature.
For the Mac, yeah, right.
I think because they wanted to save the iPad for last, because in some ways it was the most substantial of all their announcements in terms of operating system stuff, and they really wanted to kind of give it its due. But it yep. was funny, and of course, I feel like all of us were like, oh, I see what this is going to be, right? Like the moment they announced it for the Mac, I think I turned to you and I was like, so that's the iPad, right?
Right, right.
It's like yeah. that, and I think somebody in front of me, Stephen Hackett, maybe turned around and said, and like nodded, like, yeah, it was like this is I see where you're going here.
We're all picking up what you're putting down.
And I'm gonna think about this some more and write about it at some point. But like I do think on the Mac, and I have not used it on the Mac. I don't know what it's like on the Mac, but I feel like. There was an interesting blog post that Grouper linked to this week that was about somebody who worked at Apple like in the 2000s mm-hmm. who said that they were working on a thing that never shipped that was very similar. It's the same team now that shipped Stage Manager. And my immediate thought on seeing Stage Manager for the Mac is I like the idea. I don't know if it works, but I like what it says, which is full screen mode is not... good enough. And I know there are people who'll use full screen mode or use it for some apps, but my opinion is that full screen mode on the Mac is bad. My call will come next week probably. So here's why. I think a lot of us use the desktop, and I think multitasking, you know, there are rare is the app that never ever needs to leave its own borders. Even when I'm in Final Cut or Logic, which are very nations unto themselves kinds of apps, I'm still dragging in media files from the Finder, and doing that with a full screen app is kind of a pain. So when they demoed Stage Manager and they said, like, you know, you got this big window, and then you click on the desktop, or you've got a pair of windows and you click on the desktop, and it kind of like. Without a special gesture, you literally just click on the desktop, everything moves out of the way, you get the thing, and then you drag it back on. It's a little awkward because you got to drag it onto the thumbnail in Stage Manager, and then it pops, it spring loads open, and then you drop it in. But I thought, look at this, they're demoing a full screen-ish kind of thing with right. access to the desktop. And it's like, maybe this is a better... And the goal of that project in the 2000s was find a way for users who don't want... who aren't good at window management and lose windows behind other windows and things like that. Could we come up with a way that's more sort of like you can click around and the system helps you and we can show you what you want? And I think it's admirable, and I'm going to say this about Stage Manager in general. I think it is a feature with admirable goals. I can't speak to whether they achieve any of them. At mm-hmm. this point, and I suspect for the whole summer we're all going to be debating them, and I suspect for the whole summer they're going to be revising Stage Manager based on feedback, but I'm encouraged because I think it's coming from a good place, which is it's actually trying to solve some usability issues. Now, it's causing usability issues probably
sure,
in the
sure.
early betas because it's an early beta and all. I think that there's lots of people out there have made some keen observations about things that are weird about the current Beta 1 implementation of Stage Manager, and I believe it. And there's a debate to be had about whether something that's simpler, like what Microsoft does with tiling and stuff, might be a better approach than the kind of more fussy, but more possibilities, but also fussier thing that Apple is doing. But that is, if I had one takeaway, that might be it, which is I like the idea that Apple is... trying to solve some usability problems about both the Mac and the iPad And doing it with a single feature, which is really interesting. Right.
I'm intrigued to see how it plays out. I have used both full screen mode and split view on the Mac on occasion. There are a few like use cases where it comes up for me. I mean, I like when I'm writing, you know, working on fiction stuff, I have Scrivener in full screen mode because I can then just move over to it with a space and you don't get distracted, right? Which is there's a lot of other ways to do that.
And you're not dragging things in from the desktop into
exactly.
Scrivener.
I want it because I just want a full screen mode. But yeah, I agree with you because you mentioned at one point Logic. I think when you were talking about this, like, oh, I don't use Logic in full screen, even though it's giant and I want to take up as much screen real estate as possible. I'm like, yeah, I'm totally there with you. I've never used Logic in full screen mode.
Yeah,
it doesn't really make sense.
Because you got to drag in your audio files and you never
know. I mean, you could go to file, open, insert, or whatever. No one does that.
I'm sure someone does it, but like, I don't do it. And I think a lot of people are very, it's that thing about like, you got to embrace the fact that people keep stuff on their desktop. Okay. Like it's going to, or in a window on their desktop where their files are. For their project, right? You just gotta embrace that.
Those features are fine, but a split view on the iPad certainly always felt like not exactly a compromise, but like a stopgap essentially. Like, now I can at least write an email while referring to another email or write something while looking at a web page.
Operating system, which has a one app at a time concept, we've solved it. Now it thinks it's two smaller screens running one app at a time.
Right.
It's like,
let's not even get started on the half screen that you can drag over, which is kind of a weird. Yeah. Here, also, imagine there was an iPhone on your iPad. You can use that.
Laying on top of it. Partially. Yeah. Anyway, I'm so excited that they did this with the iPad. I don't know if it's going to be good. It may be kind of a mess. It may, when it ships, it may be weird. It is their first take at it. And so whatever ships, I think is going to be better than what was there before. But I want it to be good. I think it's going to get really interesting when you can have, you can basically plug an iPad in to a 27-inch studio display and sit down with a keyboard and a trackpad like I do every day with my Mac, except have it be an iPad instead. I think that's really interesting. I don't know what the most common use case is going to be for any of this. There is the other shoe that dropped this week is that there was a Mark Gurman report that there's going to be a 15-inch iPad. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, of course there is, right? Once you've got this, the ability to do the display scaling changes so you can fit more content on a screen, and you've got the ability to have the different windows around, then a larger screen on an iPad actually starts to make more sense. Whereas before, it would be like the large print edition of the iPad. It would just literally everything would be bigger. But now it doesn't have to be that way because of iPadOS 16. So
exactly.
It's interesting.
It's evolving. It's evolving, and I think that's a good thing. I think we all knew that was necessary, especially for the crowd, which, you know, the refrain amongst many iPad users for the past few years has been, the hardware on this is great. Right. Why can't I do more? And I think they're starting to address that, which is great.
Let's also put in, and not as flashy, because we've talked about the desktop class experience, and we've talked about Stage Manager. They added Swap, and apps can have up to 16 gigs of memory, and that is a computer feature that iOS didn't have. The idea that basically, how do you do it where you've got four app windows open on an external monitor and four app windows open on an iPad screen all connected together? They're going to eat all the memory up, and iOS is so aggressive about killing processes that are using a lot of memory. And the answer is they're using virtual memory like they do on the Mac. They're using the M1 and presumably eventually the M2 to do virtual memory swap, and they keep it all running. And it's, so now the iPad is vastly more computer-like than it was before.
Right. I mean, and that goes right back to what we were just talking about with the fact that the iPad grew out of the iPhone, right? It was something very tuned. The reason that the iPhone was always so aggressive about that was battery life, right? Like, you couldn't have a bunch of apps running in the background because you would basically kill your battery.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so,
I mean, they didn't even have multitasking for a while. And when they did, it was like, well,
we
got to
suspend things.
Apps,
yeah.
But,
like,
but it's going to get purged and.
Right.
Yeah, it's. I mean, I don't want to call it the original sin because that's not it. But the way to put it is the iPad is the way it is and is limited in the way it is because of iPhone limitations that made sense at the time and maybe even still make sense. And yet you had that moment where you're thinking, I in my piece on Six Colors about this, where people can read. I tried to go beyond what was in the keynote, and I watched the desktop class app sessions and see what they're trying to do there with their editable toolbars and like a document menu and an overflow menu and new. There's a whole new thing for floating, it's the edit menu basically. It's a little right. floater, but if you're using a keyboard, if you're using a pointing device, it becomes like a contextual menu. Like they're doing all of these iPad features to get it kind of back together. But in my piece, I point out like desktop class app also means things like I built all those charts and numbers for Six Colors. And one time we were at Mike's bachelor party and I had to do the charts and I brought my iPad, not a laptop. And I had a realization that there was a particular feature in Numbers mm-hmm. that, mm-hmm. And Numbers is, God, almost everything is in there. There was a particular feature that I needed in Numbers that just didn't exist on the iPad. And that, I think, is what the desktop class iPad apps thing is also trying to do, is basically Apple saying to everybody at Apple, could you look at your iPad apps and see if there are features that aren't there that are on the Mac and ask, and not put them in, but ask yourself the question, should this also be on the iPad? Because sometimes it might not make sense, but a lot of times it's like, why is this not there? And the answer is, because our code base on iPad is from the iPhone and we omitted a lot of complexity from the iPhone. And it's like, okay, then put it back in. And that's so, right. so there, and then Apple's adding the other stuff and the system wide stuff and more printing related stuff. Cause iOS was always kind of like, you don't really want to print and maybe we'll let you print a little bit, but not that much. And they're sort of saying, no, please. Not only are they giving tools to developers to do this, but they actually have gone, through their own apps and given them all kind of a once over, and it's good. It's a good thing.
Which is great. I mean, it still sort of, you know, begs the question of the two things. One, desktop app, the suggestion of desktop class apps on iPad leaves open that whole area that we have talked about a lot before, which is pro apps on the iPad. Do you consider, are those desktop class? Are they a step beyond desktop class?
I feel like they're opening the door to that, but they didn't walk through the door this week.
Exactly.
But I think the door is open now.
The additional part of that is another conversation that we've had a lot. Like there are still features not available on the iPad that Mac users are very dependent on in certain categories. Are audio features, as we've talked about before. That's a thing that's still not quite there, it
not
seems
quite
like.
There, but I actually have a little encouraging note on that side, which is that Apple is doing, there's more in, I think it's 12.3, they introduced basically screen capture, window capture kit on the Mac mm-hmm. that is meant to, as we've lamented in various places, the screen capture stuff for doing live streaming and stuff on the Mac is the state of affairs has been pretty poor. Apple actually introduced an API that specifically lets you capture video and audio from specific apps and windows on the Mac. And the, mm-hmm. the whole goal is to make the Mac better at being a streaming platform, because I know multiple people who have bought PCs in Mac households just to do video streaming, right? Like it just is a lot easier on Windows than it is on the Mac for various reasons. And Apple seems to be headed in that direction. Well, what's interesting about that is that API includes audio capture, which means I start to wonder if one day it's going to allow Audio Hijack, for example, to not do the system extension to reboots kind of thing they have to do right now, because there's an official Apple API to capture audio from the system. And the other thing I think is, well, why would they not do that on on iOS?
Sure.
Right? I mean, like, again, why would they not do that API on iOS?
This feeling. Here's the thing. I think there's a lot of people who have opinions of what Apple is doing that assume facts, not in evidence. And sometimes there are reasons, but there are a lot of people who think that Apple has deliberately held features back from the iPad pretty much so as not to cannibalize the Mac, right? Like that is kind of, I think, the implicit argument that a lot of these people have. It's like, oh, of course they'll never do that on the iPad because A, they like to keep everything locked down, and B, they don't want to turn it into too much of a Mac.
Yeah.
And I think...
they wouldn't want somebody abandoning one of their products for another one of their own products.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that's, you know... I don't think either of those makes a lot of sense when you really dig into it. Yes, there is a part of Apple that wants to be out of control, but that is the reason that you implement things like the APIs for it, right? There's no, I don't think there's any rationale on the side of Apple that's like, oh, we can't let people do audio capture on the iPad. That doesn't ring true for me, right?
No, it's more like, oh, it's really hard technically, and are people using it, and we're not going to prioritize it. But
exactly.
But you do get the case where, like, suddenly they do, and this goes back to your original point about kind of the unification and things moving in lockstep, and which is today. I see that Apple, because they did a session about it, and I didn't know it had already shipped. It actually was in macOS 12.2 or 12.3, so it's not a new feature in Ventura. It is an existing feature update that happened in Monterey. But what I think of now is, oh, you did a new capture API on macOS, and I immediately think, I wonder if that API will come to iOS too. Which didn't used to happen, right? But now I'm like, well, you guys are moving in lockstep. Like, if it's important enough on the Mac, it's probably important enough on the iPad. And it gets you access to the audio capture thing that all of us have been complaining about. And presumably, you know, being able to do something like ScreenFlow or other things where you can capture individual windows, especially now that you have windows on the iPad, it could make sense to do it that way. So we'll see where it goes, but I'm intrigued by those possibilities. That said, my understanding is that at least in developer beta 1 on the iPad, if you're playing music and then you go to a web page with a video in it, your music still stops, right. Which is just a fundamental, like, broken thing. I'm going to call it broken now. It's like, it shouldn't happen that way. Computers should be able to play two streams of audio over each other at once. Yeah, my Mac can play music to AirPlay speakers while I'm playing the audio of a YouTube video on the Studio Display speakers, right? It's fine. It's like two different audio sources and at the same time. And the iPad's like, what? Oh my God, there's a video playing. Stop everything.
Right. And again, all of this goes back to those same choices that were made,
that made sense for the
15 years ago. Yeah, absolutely. They made perfect sense. But this is where the iPad has always struggled because it's caught between the two worlds. And I think what's clear is that Apple is trying to push it more towards the Mac side of things to make it a more capable device,
understanding
that, yeah, the iPhone can also be more capable, but the iPhone has more limitations still on what people are, I think, doing with it. And that may change too, right? There may come a day where people are, who knows, recording podcasts and producing, you know, people are already producing videos and stuff like that. But like, people may do that more and more with their iPhone, and Apple may need to make adjustments there as well. But I think the iPad in particular, because it has now evolved into something that so mimics the idea of your traditional computer, right? You can have a screen with a keyboard and a pointing device connected to an external monitor, connected to external hardware, right? Like all these peripherals with USB-C.
There's now a driver kit for iPad OS.
Yep.
You
can connect a SCSI controller, Jason, which made me laugh out loud when I saw it in that session.
I can't wait till they get to back to the floppies. Then we'll really have something.
Yeah.
So, we should talk about M2 and the MacBook Air. We got to see it. I got to hold it a few times in a few places. I wrote a piece that's on the site about it. Never have I felt a contrast of excitement for two new hardware products as the M2 MacBook Air and the M2 MacBook Pro, which just all I'll say about it is it's literally everything that the old 13-inch MacBook Pro had that we were like, why does this product exist? Except they put an M2 in it. It has not changed one inch. Everything about it is exactly the same. It doesn't even have MagSafe. It's just the same thing. However, the M2 MacBook Air, they got rid of the wedge shape, but it's thin. It's thinner and lighter, less volume. The screen is bigger. It's got the notch in it, but that's one of the reasons the screen is bigger is because they're taking up more space with it. And it's got this new M2 processor, which is the next generation of Apple Silicon. And most notably, it's got new cores, you know, new CPU cores, new GPU cores. So there's performance benefit there. It's got more memory bandwidth. It's got a larger amount of max memory. So people are complaining about that, and they can go up to 24 gigs now.
Yep.
It still only supports one external display, so people who like to hook up a laptop to two external displays are still going to be sad about the MacBook Air. But I think one of the biggest and undersung things about it is the special video encode-decode blocks that they put into the M1 Pro and Max processors to speed in video encoding and decoding tasks for pros are in the M2. So it now just comes with all levels of the base model M2 has this thing that was previously in the high-end version of the M1. And what that means to me is that M2 MacBook Air, not only does it look really nice, and I think they did I think it's a really nice looking computer and I want one, but also, like, you could throw hefty video encodes at it and it's going to work, maybe not quite like an M1 Pro, but kind of. And that's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, it also gives us another data point when thinking about future Macs could come down the road with this M2, right? We've now been through an M1 cycle. We saw the M1, then we saw the Pro and Max, then we saw the Ultra. And so we have a much better idea of what Apple's strategy is for these chips. Not to say they can't change it up, but I think my guess is for the two, it's going to hew pretty close to the same. So, I think the Air is an amazing machine. It is interesting, as you know, we talked about, for obvious reasons, Apple's not going to show you benchmarks comparing the M2 to the M1 Pro or Max. It will be interesting once reviewers get their hands on them and run those, what that looks like. Because obviously there's still advantages to the Pro and the Max in terms of their architectures, but are they potentially made up for by the increase in, like, core speed and stuff in the M2? I guess we'll find out. But it's a great machine. It is interesting that both that M2 Pro and the M1 Air, which are still in the lineup, and seem very much about holding down price points.
Mm-hmm.
There was a rumor this week now that there's new MacBooks, including a new 12-inch, potentially.
Yeah, 15. Gurman, I think, said that there's a 15-inch Air in the works and a new 12-inch MacBook. I assume MacBook, but whatever they want to call it. Like a smaller model that they'll take the Air, all the laptops, do all the laptops, I guess. But that's fine. I like little laptops, and the M2 Air, as light as it is and as small as it is, I would be intrigued by like an M2 or M3 12-inch MacBook Air or MacBook.
You and I were both 11-inch MacBook Air users, I think loved that form factor. And even now, I mean, my 13-inch Air is really nice. It's a great computer. It's still kind of big and heavy. Like, I was carrying it around this week along with like an iPad and everything. And I was like, I don't know. This is just it's still kind of weighty. So there's room. There's room under that. I think I'm intrigued to see where this continues to go. Yeah.
And also it feels good. Like it feels like now that Apple Silicon is kind of off and running, Apple, this is what I would hope would happen, which is I feel like Apple now has the opportunity to iterate on the Mac product line in a way they haven't done in a long time. And Mac Studio is kind of the first one of those that we've seen. But like, if these rumors are true, the idea that you could have a 12-inch MacBook Air, a 13.8 or whatever it is MacBook Air, a 15-inch MacBook Air, 13, 14, 16 MacBook Pros, like, yeah, like, do it. 75%, probably more, of the Macs that Apple sells are laptops. Having more options for laptops kind of makes sense, right? Like,
well, this is the thing we talked about when the Studio came out, was like, well, we've got high powered, you know, the Mac Studio, we've got a Mac Pro still in the offing there. There's maybe a bigger iMac that will, you know, show up again someday.
It's like a lot of desktops, right?
There's a lot of desktops, especially a lot of high end desktops, right? Like, you know,
and then only four laptops, one of which doesn't make any sense.
Right,
I guess it's five because you got the M1 Air there too. But still,
that's
why not have more diversity in the lineup on the laptop side. And I think that they're going there. I think that the you look at this Air, I mean, it's very clear the M1 Air, as great a system as that is, keep in mind, remember the history here. There was no Retina Air for a very long time. They came out with a MacBook. They came out with that MacBook Escape, the low-end MacBook Pro. Mm-hmm. They tried to kill the MacBook Air, but they were priced too high. People kept buying the MacBook Air, even though it was no Retina. And so they finally gave up, and they did that Brooklyn event where they're like, all right, here's a Retina Air. And then they did the version with the better keyboard, and then they did the M1 version. But it was like they were so burned that they just were like, just make it in the shape of the old one. So they did for quite a while. This new one isn't in the shape of the old one. So it is Apple kind of like officially recommitting to the Air as an ongoing thing that they're going to be able to redefine. It's not just a nostalgia trip. They're going to be able to redefine it and still kind of slide it in there. And that's, you know, that's all good. It is interesting that the M1 Air is still there, and it does throw.
Yeah,
it makes me think about, like, because what it really means is that the M1 Air started at $999 and the right, or was it $1099?
Well, the M1 Air started at $999.
And so now they're like, we're going to keep it at $999, and the M2 Air just costs more. It just costs $1,199.
And is that because we couldn't make it cost $999? Like, or is that because, I mean, you know,
or do they
chain,
just like,
et cetera.
I mean, honestly,
do
the M1 Air is so good, things? Why stop selling it? But they could have sold it for like $899 and sold the M2 for $1,099, and they didn't do that. But the M1 Air is still
also
really good.
Yeah. Right, I mean, the M1 Air is still really good, but you always end that weird twilight zone with Apple where you're like, but for $100 more, you could get, you know, the next generation.
Yeah,
I mean, that 13-inch Pro is the one that gets me because, for all the reasons we discussed. But the funniest part to me is, like, there literally was, as you said, there was that MacBook Escape that was the same model without the Touch Bar.
Yeah.
And it's like, but they chose to keep making the one with the touch bar. So they, like, it literally must be like a HomePod thing where it's like, we've just got all of these touch bars.
I hate to say it, and I would be happy if somebody told me that this is not actually what's going on here. But I'm really struggling to figure out why that product exists. Honestly, I never before have I seen an Apple product where I'm like, I don't know why you're making this. I don't know why this thing exists.
It must literally be for price points,
so
right?
Because
the 14-inch starts at $2,000. So
yeah, here are my theories. Theory one is they literally have the chassis and the touch bars, and they know they can't sell it as an M1 anymore, so they put the M2 in it. But basically, it's like, just we know how to make this thing. We can make it cheap, so let's get it out there. I think that there is. So that's theory one. Theory two is there are institutional buyers who won't buy an Air. For whatever reason, we only buy professional laptops, so we have to buy a MacBook Pro. So they basically made something that's the same performance as the Air, but they call it a Pro, and it starts at this lower price, so that the people who are like, well, I'm only buying a MacBook Pro have an option. And then three is related to that, which is the good, better, best, which is you got to have a good to upsell everybody to better. So you can say that the MacBook Pro line starts at whatever, $1,299, $1,399. I don't know what its base price is. If you configure them the same, it's literally the same as the M2 Air,
right.
But it's a lot cheaper than the 14 Pro, which is a lot better computer. So you end up in this situation where it exists to hold down that price point, as you said. And that's all I got, because like the only superiority it has, other than if you like the Touch Bar, because it doesn't have MagSafe and, but it does have
it has
a bigger
active,
battery, and it has the fan.
Cooling. Yeah.
But the reality is that the M1 and M2 are so efficient that you're only going to really see the advantage of having
the
a fan
advantage,
if you're pushing it so hard with a GPU, because even the CPUs aren't going to heat it up enough. And at that point, if you're doing super GPU intensive work, maybe you should get the 14-inch,
right?
Like, maybe you should pay a little more money. So it's like, so that's the who's it for, is like for people who need that extra GPU performance, but can't spend a few hundred dollars to go up to the next model. It's like, wow, we are slicing this thing really thin, which is why I come back to, I think it's to get people in stores for a lower price and then they don't buy it. And it's for companies. Literally, it's they have companies that say you need to have a MacBook Pro available at a low price.
Apple,
point.
We love the Touch Bar. Bring us more Touch Bars.
Yeah, and now all the Touch Bar people, all the Touch Bar stands out there, enjoy.
Sorry. Don't.
I don't think I've
you.
Actually used stands it's, on a podcast before.
No,
so
that's pretty
first.
Good. That's very modern.
It's like Harry's. It's like Harry Styles fans. It's like a Touch Bar's house. It's a cultural reference.
I also think, you know, the other shoe that's the end of that is the supply chain stuff, right? Like, we know pretty well that MacBook Air was supposed to ship a while back, which also suggests that basically everything else in the pipeline is delayed.
I think it's fair to say that MacBook Pro is not the future of the MacBook line.
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. I mean, if it were, there would be touch bars in all the other laptops they released.
Yeah, and it would have MagSafe and stuff, and it doesn't even... I mean, that's the one that's the unkindest cut of all. It's like, well, we put MagSafe in the Air, but still not on this thing. It's just what it is. It's to hit that.
It's
to,
you know,
to exist. Its job is to exist.
There's
really,
always, we talk about this all the time. There's always something in the lineup, even especially in the Mac, where you're like, why is that thing still there? Right? There was the one with the optical drive stuck around for a while. There's a non-retina one that stuck around for a while. And the answer is almost always pricing. Like, I think is like, there's a niche. There's a small niche, and they're like, we need to cover that niche. It's cheap. Let's just keep around this old product. We already can make them pretty well. We've got the parts, et cetera.
Yeah.
And until we can, like, sort of phase everything out. But the lineup is never that perfect grid that you want it to be.
No, it's like, we talk about, like, in astronomy, like the size of a galaxy and stuff like that. And it's like, but the truth is the light, like, the time for a galaxy to rotate, but like, you can't see the other side of the galaxy because of the speed of light. You're seeing it in the past and all that. Like, there is like present time in the galaxy. It's like that. It's like these time scales where, like, you never have a perfect lineup of products from Apple because it's always changing and it's always in process. And so there's always a straggler, or in this case, what's weird about it is they put the M2 in it. So it's new, but it's old in every appreciable way except the processor. That part is weird, but you're right. It's a straggler. It's obviously not a product that is long for this world. It's the only laptop that doesn't have MagSafe. Well, I mean, and the previous model M1, but we know that M1 Air is an old product still available. This M2 Pro is a new product that is really an old product, and it isn't long for this world. It is the past, but it needs to exist because the thing that's supposed to exist in that slot isn't available yet. So there it sits.
Yep. There you go. That's the opportunity.
And maybe it's not important enough to Apple priority-wise to replace it, right? It's like, they've been making those parts a long time. It's probably pretty cheap to make it. I would say, wouldn't it be cheaper if you didn't have the touch bar in it? But I don't know. Maybe they made a lot of them. I don't know. Weird. I'm excited about the M2 Air, and the M2 in general looks really good. I'm looking forward to testing one someday. I'm disappointed that they didn't do more aggressive colors. They made four different colors, except they're all non-colors. It's silver and space gray and midnight and starlight, which is like, I mean, I love the midnight one. It is black with this blue undertone, so it looks black until you get it in the right light, and then it becomes this dark blue, and it's very pretty. But, like, I'm disappointed that they didn't do a color, right? A brighter, like, this one really stands out kind of thing, especially since they did silver and space gray and the starlight, which is basically like a gold undertone silver, so it's more, you know, subtly gold. It's silver with a yellow undertone instead of a blue undertone.
Nice, but not the colors that we had hoped for, but the colors we have gotten.
I was hoping it would be iMac colors, but even so, you do four colors, and I don't know, they're really boring. And it's also weird because I thought silver and space gray were on their way out to be replaced by midnight and starlight, but they just did them both. So,
right.
Okay. All right.
We had a bunch of those metals lying around too, and we just decided to go with that.
Yeah.
Disappointing, but it's fine. It's still, it's choice, and, you know, you can pick whatever color you want, as long as one of those four.
Anyway, I think the midnight one looks great. And I want one, and I will probably buy one at some point because, it's right up my alley. I'm looking forward to that. So before we go, we should talk about the fact that not only were we together, but we were at Apple Park in the Ring building.
In the Ring.
You've never been to Apple Park. I've been to the Steve Jobs Theater many times now, although it's been a couple of years. Something happened there. But What I said while we were walking there is you go through the Tantau gate, basically the security entrance, and then you go left and up the hill to the Steve Jobs Theater, and we went right. And I'm like, oh, man, here we go. And we went to that thing. And all I can really say about it is what I've been telling people is it's way more impressive than it looks in pictures. Like, it's the scope of it. The scale of it is enormous.
Yeah.
And the detail work, like, it is.
Oh, yeah.
If you think about every Apple store, especially like a showcase Apple store that's got all the special custom tables and that, like, everything has been thought through very carefully. That the entire enormous building, every inch of it is like that.
It's fascinating, having talked to a couple people throughout the week who work at Apple, I get the impression that as a place to work, it is not always the best because it has got that Johnny Ive sort of like, I'm really interested in how this looks and maybe not exactly how this works as a place of business. Like, it feels like a museum, basically, I think it is does. One of the best examples I give. It's like a really beautiful space, and it has that sort of wild vibe to it that is like everything has been detail oriented and they've thought about all these little like the handrails on the stairwells, right? Or these weird little, like, I don't even know how to describe it. Like, Stephen Hackett was with me at one point in the visitor center. He's like, I wish I brought like a ball bearing. I could just roll down these handrails because they're like little chutes almost.
Yep.
I walked in at one point when we were going up to the reception area, and there was this like three level, like little atrium that we were kind of in before we walked in the reception, over to where the elevators were. And there were like people posted at like this like part on each of the like sort of little walkways. And I leaned over, I think David Sparks is like, I feel like I'm in like an imperial facility. Like it's a little ominous at times. But it's impressive. It's an impressive piece of architecture.
Yeah.
You know, we talked about you looking in from the inside of the ring to look across the ring. It's so enormous, and you know, there's all this space in the middle that's all full of trees and grass and all this open stuff. And even walking around the outside, they've got these like wild fences and everything. Like, it really does. I cannot think of anything else that is quite like it. It is unique.
And you, depending on your vantage point, it does feel like you're out, like all that there is the ring. Because when you look out at the ring, especially from the side that we were on, you see the trees on the inside of the ring, you see the other side of the ring, and then the elevation of the other side of the ring building means that the next thing you see is the hills back in the background.
Right.
So
right.
It, you're totally isolated. It's an isolating feeling too, in a good way, but like intentionally, you don't think that you're in a city, right? You're at Apple Park, and Apple Park is all that there is when you're there. But it was beautiful. I'm really glad that we got a chance to see it. I didn't think that would ever happen, that they would do an event like this, but COVID kind of intervened. So I was glad to see all of our colleagues that you mentioned, a bunch of them. It was fun to walk around. I feel like it's going to be like this. This is my Macworld column this week, which I should probably post on Six Colors because I haven't done that. I should do that. It's been a very busy week. I think that this is the model for the future, right? Which is an event maybe at the Steve Jobs Theater. In the long term, you invite developers, you give them an opportunity of a lifetime. It's a small number, but it doesn't really matter because it's a small number of developers regardless, right?
Right. Sure.
And so I feel like this is going to be the way it is from now on.
I'm intrigued to see. So Apple has done some stuff to support the community as well, right? Like a bunch of podcasts recorded episodes in a very nice studio that they set up. The talk show was done in an auditorium on Apple campus. I'm kind of curious to see what future, if that is indeed a template and there are future possibilities for that kind of thing expanding to Apple hosting more community events. And then I have conflicted feelings about that, right? Because it is, you know, Apple is the linchpin of this community for obvious reasons. But, you know, it is interesting when Apple is in control of one of those events, as opposed to when those events are done sort of, you know, independently. I don't know how that impacts it, if at all. I don't think it really, I mean, John Gruber is John Gruber. You can't really do too much to him. But, you know, I think he, and he is not somebody who is going to necessarily feel like he has to soften coverage because Apple is being nice and putting on his event. But I think it's interesting to have Apple be with everything centered at the campus. Like the one thing that I noticed, for example, I'm sure you were sort of bouncing around a little bit more than I was. You know, in the past in San Jose, the community had like everything was very walkable and you could like run into people. There was a lot of sort of, you know, nice serendipity of visiting with people. There's not really a similar place to do that because if you're part of the community, but you're not at an Apple sponsored event, there's nothing else there. So there's not like a place to gather that is not under Apple's aegis in some way. And maybe that's fine because it's an Apple sponsored event, but it does raise some complications just in terms of logistics and hosting stuff that is sort of parallel or ancillary. And Apple did do some stuff as well, I think online too, to sort of, you know, promote other events, which is great. But it is, you know, it is a template, a good template for an event, but it is something that definitely has significant differences from the way that it used to be held.
Yeah. It'll change, right? Because I feel like they'll probably, that if they had their druthers, they'd just do it at the Steve Jobs Theater, which has got a big capacity.
Sure, right.
And it would have been fine. Although it's certainly the outdoor thing has a sort of festival appeal to it. And I could see them doing something for developers and, at the Apple Park campus, but they've got the Developer Center now too. Yeah. It's all part of the event planning kind of aspect of it, but like they own the real estate, like they control everything. It's better. Like it's better this way. This is the way to do it.
Sure.
So yeah, I think this is the way going forward. And honestly, like being in a city like San Jose and even San Francisco, like, although you don't have that center of gravity, which is a bunch of hotels around a convention center, it's still like, and it's not a whole week.
Right.
It's essentially a media and developer event for a day or two. And that's, I think that's enough. I think that given that everything else is online, I think that it's an okay model. So I expect we'll be doing something very similar next year.
Yep. I think that's probably right. I'll book in my flights now.
Sure. Get ready. All right, well, that's it for now. Obviously, more to come. We're watching sessions. We're doing write-ups. There's a lot going on here. So much going on. My son's still sleeping, though, so.
Working off that graduation hangover.
He can sleep as long as he wants. All right, well, we will be back next week. But until then, bye, Dan.
Bye, Jason.